This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you in an entirely unexpected way to share with you things that you'll never hear anyplace else. And the first thing that I'm going to share is a poem, because you asked for it. And first, let me tell you something about the way I write poetry. My poetry is a journal. It's a journal of all the things I think and feel and kind of touch and taste with my mind. And the first poem I'm going to share with you, and if you're lucky, that'll be the last poem that I share with you, is going to be about 9/11. All of us remember that moment in time when the world changed, September 11th, 2001. And the world wasn't the same after that, was it? We watched the towers come down, and we watched in many ways our lives rended in ways that we couldn't even imagine. This is the poem that I wrote immediately after. It's number 20 in the Violet series. Crimson blossoms sheer and rend. Crimson roses rent the sky, bringing down the off sun, fracturing the pillared towers, and death writ red as flowers. My mind could not accept the changes sudden that deformed. The world I knew was shattered there, inside an autumn newly born. The scene surreal with tears, the shock, the frantic search for those we love, chilled tones and dust-choked eyes, the fall of towers from the sky, deforming march of memories, rescinding tones of history, from shock surrendered steel-bent scope, was reborn the edge of hope, courage spent, heart's hope's own gift, lives to save meant more than risk, shroud of dust that cloaked the sky, a cloak of courage death denied. A thousand little moments bled in mind-made journey, grief unsaid. And human actions touched each mind, tiny echoes of the divine. Erupting roses burned our eyes, remaking worlds we did not see. Recasting our unthought beliefs, replacing them with soul's sheared grief. Transforming death, unbending love, the unreflected will to hope. These the gifts that roses brought to worlds that need to find new scope. This is what I wrote, remembering what I had seen. But since this is a very spontaneous sort of program that we're going to have tonight, I'm also going to share with you something that I was writing today. And that's about... That's about something that I think is really impacts each one of us. And this is something that I'd really like you to consider. We're at a cusp time right now. We can see that we're approaching a tremendous potential for fracturing along every line that you can imagine. Men and women have been put in an adversarial position with each other, Republicans and Democrats. Look at each other, across chasms, ethnic groups. There's practically no way that you can look at the world as it is today and not see chasms that divide humanity one from another on the basis of gender, on the basis of our age, on the basis of our ethnic background and our beliefs. And that's not really a good place for us to be, is it? So today what I was doing is I was writing something that's going to go into a book that I have been working on. And the book's called Revoking the License to Steal, Americans Can Gun Themselves. This is sort of how that begins. We read words on paper and convert those words into ideas, giving them context in our minds with a depth and breadth reflecting our own understanding, and using that myriad of human tools available variously to each of us. Ideas existing first in our minds are the raw material from which all human tools have been created. The flint blade found in the most primitive dig in Africa, intentionally wrought, was first an idea. The flint blade, the artifact, a material representation that we can see, illustrates the idea in the mind of a prehuman, now dust and bits of bone. The relationship between the artifact and the blade is a constant in human culture. First, the idea is posed in the mind. The same is true for human tools of layered complexity. For instance, a shuttlecraft, and for the cup that holds the water we drink. Complex and owing from the thoughts of many compiled through time, or simple and arising from the thoughts of one individual, they share the same genesis. The same is true for those most dynamic and complex human tools, the infrastructure of human society, the world in which you and I both live. We think that world into existence. Look at the world around you. We have put it into place. It exists because of our act of will. By mutual acceptance, acknowledgement of common ideas, we keep our world in place. The human world changes constantly as new ideas are introduced and accepted by enough of us to make them the norm. Conflict between people arises when people hold different ideas regarding their cultural structures and their beliefs. And we've all seen that, haven't we? After that early human discovered she could convey ideas through speech, it was probably not very much longer before she also discovered that conveying false ideas, lying, could all serve to her benefit. I use the female gender, not because women are more likely to lie, but because the neurobiology of the human brain and the difference between that structure in men and women indicates that women are more verbally balanced, and therefore it is more likely that women were the first to use speech to communicate. This reflects in the fact that women are provably better able to work cooperatively. This is also reinforced by the fact the most normal form of organization for women is a matrix. A network of cooperative relationships that would be benefited by the use of language. Think about the world that you live in. Think about the last time you volunteered. Think about the people who keep things going when it's not really interesting anymore and it's not fun. It's usually the women, isn't it? Very different form for organization, most natural for men and women. And that difference has driven human action, like a foundational subtext. Commented on until recently because humans didn't possess the tools, the ideas to form the context in which to understand them. The advances of understanding in the last quarter of the 20th century have provided an inkling of the richness of understanding yet to come. That's something that we're only just starting to see here at the first moments, the first birth of the next millennium. What we're seeing is what the potential is going to be for human action and what our world is going to look like for the next 1,000 years. But as with all changes in time, we're also seeing a conflict of monumental proportions as old and the new try to find a new balance. And that balance has brought, you know, that coming into balance has brought us into a new understanding and a whole diversity of new human disciplines that give us insight into the way the world is and into what the future can be. At the same time, it helps us better understand what the past has been. The pattern for the interpretation of a new structure for human knowledge came from the first theological structures, enforcing and limiting rules by gender and philosophies, and then to disciplines such as medicine, psychology, archaeology, anthropology, sociology, and others. Any of us have probably tasted those things. We've read articles about them. Perhaps we've studied them in depth. But each of those things also reaches out to create a unified field theory, potentially, if we follow the ramifications, so that we can see in more wholeness than it was ever possible exactly the dimensions and depth and breadth of the world in which we're going to live. Theology changed about 6,000 years ago, and I think a lot of us know now exactly what started to happen then. We've been looking at a past, a human past, of 20,000 or more years with a fairly stable human spiritual belief system that had a female deity. And about 6,000 years ago, that started to change. It changed in some ways that were significant that actually create parallels if you understand the way that human structures for organization exist today. You had a female deity, a prime female deity, and then you had a son who was a secondary deity. And then after a number of hundreds or thousands of years, you had a co-equal, male and female deity, and then, curiously enough, the female deity started to disappear. At the same time, certain other things were introduced into culture. And one of those things, slavery. The idea of a human being could own another, just their body or their person, but their labor, and even try to sink that control into their spirit so that they would see themselves differently in the context of the human culture that all had created. That was an interesting period in our existence. It's been playing itself out for about 6,000 years now. One of the things that we see changing today is the concept of the idea that one human being can own another, either directly or through a series of covenants enforced by culture and law. And here now, at the turn of the new millennium, there's certain things that, you know, that we still confront as people, right? We confront a world where women, in the nation that's ever been seen on the face of the earth, still aren't given equal rights. The ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, is still hangs in the balance, still has not been ratified. We look at a world where women are still very unsafe, where the stance for what's acceptable for a woman and what's acceptable for a man are still different, and perhaps they always will be, because there are real biological differences between us, aren't there? But the balance of all those things, one of the things that we each must confront is what we're going to do about it. As we take a look back in time and we see the way that philosophies were used to create actually a wealth transfer from women to men, and we see the way that that idea of a centrist state, of a hierarchy, was used to reinforce that. If we take a look at all the ways in which that impacts us still today, then at the same time, one of the things that we can do is we can take that vision and we can turn it inward and we can consider something about what we are going to do ourselves with that world. And if you do an analysis of the way that you act in the world and what you are with the world, that can give you an interesting vision about what you need to do to be different. Because, and this is an interesting example, because this can take us back in time to a place in history where people had to make a choice about what they were going to do. And I'm going to tell you two stories, and I want you to think about the ramifications. You've all heard about the Salem witchcraft trials. You know that in 1692, in the New World, there was a reign of terror that took place in New England, especially grouped around the Salem area. And first you had a couple women who were accused and hanged, and then the claws of authority reached out, and they accused around 130 women and men of witchcraft. And there was a reason for that. And the reason for that actually doesn't go to any misconception about the spiritual. It goes to some very specific and concrete things about the world in which those people lived. And that lesson actually holds some real insight for us today. Because in that world, witchcraft was a capital crime. And a capital crime, if you were accused of a capital crime, all of your assets were forfeit to the state. So that if you had a farm, if you had animals, if you had the clothes on your back, those things could be seized, taken, and sold or used in any way that the state wanted. At the same time, they didn't have to compensate you and they didn't have to try you. So the reality that confronted these people was that their property was seized, they were thrown in jail, and jail, we think it might be bad today, but then you were thrown in jail and you were there. And they didn't feed you. If you were going to be sick, family had to either bring the food or the money so that you could continue to live. And if you take a look at the people who were in the families of the accusers, and you take a look at the people who were in the families of the accused, there was a curious thing that was going on. There was a very definite and specific relationship between the families of the accused and the state. You probably remember the names of Cotton and Increase Mather from school. Cotton and Increase Mather were the two pastors, the two ministers, actually, who prosecute trials. And what they allowed to happen was that they allowed this to go on. At the same time, they were very well aware, along with the other families that were involved as the accusers, that you had women who were being accused, their property seized, their bodies incarcerated, and the money that was being taken was going to benefit the families of the accusers. And in a nutshell, it's a tiny acorn for something that was going to grow into something that was disturbing, that is still with us today. You see the cooperative efforts between the state and corporations. You see that when you have this collusion between the power of the state and people who are simply greedy and want to use other people's property as their own, they will find a way to do it. And why does it matter? Because today we're facing the same thing. It's less localized. We don't necessarily know all the people who are doing it, but it's pretty much the same thing. And if you take a look at the whole past of human history, and this is one of the reasons one should study history, you see the same themes repeated over and over and over again. And what could have kept this from happening? Why were women more vulnerable? One of the reasons was that they didn't have the same standing under law. So if a woman was accused, she couldn't go into court really and effectively defend herself. She didn't have the standing. And the women that were accused, they weren't all widows. Many of them had husbands who were actually away fighting in the Indian Wars. And if you bring this whole theme forward and you take a look at the same families, you notice an interesting divergence. Because for five generations after the witchcraft trials, and this is something that most people aren't aware of at all, there was no intermarriage between these families. The person in a family of the accusers married into the families of the accused. So did they remember? You bet they did. The only reason that the trials actually ended and the people who were incarcerated in Salem Jail were actually freed was because the accusers went too far. They accused the wife of the governor, Governor Phillips. And it was a man who, for sure, his wife was not a witch. She was guilty of none of this. And the signing of a paper, he freed all of those incarcerated and forced me to pay another cent and that this foolishness was to be over with immediately. Having done that, what do you imagine that the accusers did? Were they outraged? Did they go, they asked people to change this because, you know, obviously these women needed to be prosecuted because they had done something wrong? No. They did immediately take action. The action that was immediately taken by the accusers was to go to the governor and beg that he protect them because they understood that they were vulnerable. They understood that the people that they had accused, who they had harmed, who they had held in jail for a year in some cases, were going to be very angry. And for the rest of their lives, they went a year because they always believed that these people who they knew that they had accused unjustly would take action against them. And you know something? They were wrong. In the aftermath of the Salem witchcraft trials, there was not one act of violence against the accusers. Which, if you think about it, and you think about other events in American history, is rather astonishing. If people involved hadn't been who they were, if they hadn't had a strong sense of civility and social responsibility and a disinclination to be violent, you could have seen a replay of what we think of as the Hatfields and the McCoys going on to this day. Because the amount that was stolen and the number of people who were killed and the way in which they were killed was truly horrific. And so when you think about how bad people are, sometimes consider how good they can be. The same people, the people who had so harmed, did actually eventually take action. And Salem answered them. In 1711, Salem, Massachusetts, became the first and only governmental body in a human history to make amends and pay restitution for having wrongly persecuted the victims of the Salem witchcraft trial. Did they pay a lot? No. But did they pay something? Yes. And did they at the same time make the admission that what they had done was wrong, inappropriate, and indefensible? Yes, they did. That in itself is the kind of moral victory that we need. And I think one of the reasons that you didn't see violence, you didn't see the level of conflict that could have been present in this community, was because at least there was an admission that wrong had been done. Which brings me to a point that I'd like each of you to think about. When wrong is done, restitution is one thing. Getting some, you know, being made whole is important. But the other part of that needs to be present with each of us is that when wrong is done, two parties and the population in general need to see that balance is going to be recreated between the parties. And that's not just done for the victim. That's also done for the guilty party. Because each of us needs to know what the limits are, what we can do and what we can't do. Let's take this for a moment. We'll leave Salem, Massachusetts behind, and let's think about this in terms of what it means when we look at our government today. How many of you do you think have actually heard the argument that the government can't be held accountable because of something called sovereign immunity? What's that mean? What's a sovereign? A sovereign is a monarch. A sovereign is somebody who is immune because it's really their institution and they own it. How does that contrast with the foundational philosophy on which America was founded? Let's think about that for a minute. Is there a case saying that America's government is sovereign? Think about that. I don't really think there is there? Because if you think about what the Declaration of Independence meant, what it meant was that each of us was sovereign. Let me read something. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That the secured rights governments are instituted among men, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed. That when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. And those are the ideas that were set forth in the Declaration of Independence. They were enunciated in the Declaration of Independence penned by Thomas Jefferson. And it's very clear that what they had in mind isn't anything like the government that we have today. Watched George Bush assert that he has a right to executive privilege. When he asserts what he means by executive privilege, it sounds a lot like sovereign immunity to me. When you take a look at the kind of lack of transparency in this government, you can see that they're acting on a model not of the individuals that pre-exist government, but on the idea that they control what is no longer rights, but what are privileges, that they have a right to either grant, as a monarch would grant, or withhold, as a monarch could withhold. How do you come to a conversion like this? How do you come to a conversion of rights that are absolute, that pre-exist government, that had their spiritual genesis, not in the idea of government, but in the idea that each of us has a relationship with the sacred, because that really was where the whole idea of American freedom came from. While American freedom was also a civil idea, an idea about government, it was essentially and immediately and originally an idea about the relationship that each of us has with God or the sacred. People who originally came to the New World, Puritans, Quakers, people who were fleeing from oppression, they carried in their minds an idea, and the idea was that each of them be sovereign, that government didn't have a right to make decisions about the way they were going to live their life, how they were going to worship their God, how they were going to understand themselves, and how they were going to relate with others. They came with many different versions of that, but they came with the same desire, the desire to be free. Having invested the time in what was then a very long and hazardous duty across the ocean and what was at that point, you know, more like a bucket than a boat, they got here, they faced starvation. They lived generations working with the idea of what freedom meant and how that was going to create the world in which they were going to live. And some of us come from big cities, some of us come from small towns. But I don't know how many of us have an idea just how small their world was in a lot of ways. For instance, the first settlement of Andover, Massachusetts. How big was it? Anybody who's driven through there today knows that it's a fairly substantial small town. It may be 100,000, over 100,000 people. At the time when it was homesteaded in the 1620s, it was 9 families. 9 families living on the edge of what was then seemed to be an endless wilderness. At that point in time, they didn't even know where the Pacific Ocean was. They had no idea, you know, what lay between. There was a vastness about it that was probably frightening. But they moved in, they built their homes, they persisted, and they lived with the idea of that immediate relationship with God, and that defined them and how it defined the world in their eyes. Because the whole idea of coming to the New World had been, for the Puritans and the Quakers, part of that religious journey that they were taking as individuals. The Puritans had decided that this was going to be what they called the Great Experiment. They intended to plant a place on Earth where God could build his city on the hill and they would be his agents. Work out the way that they thought it was going to? Probably not. Matter of fact, I'm sure it didn't work out the way they thought it was going to work out. But at that point in time, as we've heard today, they were very much expecting the second coming. They expected it imminently. They thought they were putting in place the preconditions for that to happen. And you've heard of the Doomsday Book. You know that, you may know that, yes, we go back and we use it as a genealogical resource. But the reason that it originally came into existence was for something entirely different. The Doomsday Book was exactly what it purports to be. The King of England decided, since it was the millennium, and Jesus Christ, therefore, must be coming back almost immediately, they needed to be able to hand him a record of everybody who was then living so that he would have that for his own records. And in very much the same pattern, when New England was settled, the Puritans began their own sort of Doomsday Book. And that was actually the instructions to the Puritans who settled, that they would keep immaculate records of the birth of their children, of their marriages, and of their death. So when Jesus Christ arrived, they would be able to hand to him that record that they expected him to be able to use to know their names. And I think it's about 47 times in the last 2,000 years, groups have, in one way or another, because they believed that that way it was going to be, gotten ready for the advent of the second coming. For a long time after the actual birth of Christ, people waited. They didn't write anything. They expected him to be back. They expected him to bring a new millennium, to bring something that was unimaginable. And they waited. And they waited. And they waited some more, because he didn't come back, at least not in that particular form. Instead, what they did was confront the fact that we're going to have to live as his people and try to exemplify what it meant to be a Christian. It might seem like I've gone kind of far afield here, but I haven't really, because inherent in the idea of the great experiment, inherent in the idea of what do you do if you focus on the idea that you have spiritual autonomy, is the idea of what is your relationship with all of the other people spread across the face of the earth. When Jesus spoke during his life ministry, he didn't make any divisions between believers and non-believers of any kind. And when those early Christians lived out their lives, they decided that they were going to try to live as they believed Jesus would want them to live. So what they did, instead of speaking their Christianity and their belief, they acted it out. And the fact that most people today, at least in the Western world, are Christians, has its genesis in the fact that they acted out what their beliefs were. Their beliefs were that every other human being was body and spirit, one with them, in a brotherhood with Jesus Christ. And since that's what they believed, what were their actions toward others, most of the people around them being pagans? Well, one of the ways that we can understand what that was is we can take a look at what they did in the most dire of circumstances. In the period of time, as happened later in the Middle Ages, there were occasionally plagues that would fall upon the people like wolves. And the practice of pagans had generally been that if somebody in your family became ill, you left them and you abandoned them, because they were very well aware if somebody was ill, that person could, you know, could pass the illness on to someone else. So the survival rate for people who came down with the plague in the period of the 300 years after the death of Christ was not good, unless you were a Christian or you lived near a Christian. Pagans living near Christians were nursed by Christians, because their Christian belief was that since this person was body and blood, a member of their family, just like their own flesh, they extended nursing services to them. They didn't do a lot. They kept them dry. They kept them clean. They gave them food and water. And because they did that, 70% of these people would recover. Well, it's about safety nets today. Then you think about what it meant to be a Christian, which was a very marginal kind of existence in some ways. It wasn't that they were poor, it's that they were persecuted. See the value of being part of a group of people who you know are going to take care of you, that they have demonstrated what their philosophical and theological beliefs are, and all of a sudden, being a Christian looks different to you. Looks like a pretty good deal. And to be a part of that kind of community and part of that expression of love was what made Christianity the dominant religion by the time of Constantine. It wasn't that somebody passed the law. It was that it had demonstrated that it worked, and it grew very slowly. It grew at a rate of just a few percentage points over every decade of 300 years, but it grew very consistently because the people who considered themselves to be Christians and lived a Christian life exemplified those particular values. And one of the things that each of us looks for today, I think, as we try to wind our way through the morass of rhetoric that we have coming at us from the media and from politicians and from places of all kinds, is to discernment between what is reality, how does that person really think, what do they really do? If I could look into their soul, what would I see, and what would they really be, and what do they say? And one of the problems with having confused these two things is it makes it very difficult for us to discriminate between the two. Which is, brings me back to one of the other points that I'd like us to consider, that we need to, as we look at the idea of a justice system, and we look at the idea that if here is somebody who's done something wrong, one of the things that they need is they need to be brought live to the fact that their actions are the things that are real. Their actions are things that will be remembered. Their actions are the things that matter. Their actions are the things that they're going to take to God at the end of their life if they believe. Or actually, if they don't believe, they're still going to take that with them. Each of us have a different way of looking at our spirituality. Some of us accept the idea of reincarnation. Some of us just accept the idea that in this life we're living it with Christ. Some of us accept the idea that Muhammad is our prophet, and we try to live in accordance to the covenant that he created. Some of us live according to whatever belief system that we had. But if you take a look at those belief systems, they really have a lot in common. None of them tell you that it's really okay to do horrible things to other people. All of those belief systems try to tell you that you really are accountable. And really, in some ways, a lot of difference between the belief systems of our religions and the belief systems of our justice system. And the places where our justice system is broken are ways in which, if you reflect what the reality is in terms of our other beliefs, of our spiritual beliefs, you can see what needs to be changed. What needs to be changed is people need to understand that they will be held accountable. And curiously enough, this brings us to an economic point. So there are lots of different economic systems, but one of the best models for economics is actually Austrian economics, because it doesn't tell you what laws you should pass. It doesn't tell you anything about that. What it tells you is how people should deal with each other. It tells you that each person, by the way that they register their needs and their virtues and their wealth and their labor in the system, enables them, almost like a hundred billion little cars driving toward a future that create a weaving that shows you what the future should be able to offer to each of us. So if you asked an Austrian economist what sort of legislation should be passed so that somebody, you know, one group of people should, you know, could have more than the other, they would say, well, that's just wrong. That's something that should never happen. If you ask somebody who would consider themselves a free market economist of the Austrian school, who is a utilitarian, they'd say, well, yes, tell us what sort of business outcome you want to get, and we'll tell you how to get it. It's something that actually takes you back to that example that we had in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692, because what was going on there was, how can we use the law, policy, change the outcome so that some people are going to be better off and some people are going to lose? And that's the difference there. The difference is that some people want to be able to use these things that we have called tools and laws to be able to steal from other people. They want to justify those things sometimes through religious means. They want to justify them through what they say are the best for the most. They just end every way that you can possibly imagine. Just like for how many years, people, especially men, use custom law to try to keep women from exercising their own rights. They used arguments that were truly amazing. I don't know if you've ever considered, if you've ever gone back and read what some of those arguments were. A lot of them were mutually contradictory, and I'd like to think about that. That was, women were too much this, too little that, too smart, too sneaky, too physically weak, and too intellectually inferior. They were done by God to be ruled by men. There's no limit to the amount of specious arguments that one group can come up with to try to reason away that they should be able to take advantage of another group of people. And that's another thing you should think about. When you think about the arguments you hear in politics, a couple things you should always look at. If you follow that argument to its logical conclusion, who's going to win? Is it going to give somebody an advantage over somebody else? Who's advancing the argument? If the person advancing the argument, are they advancing it on behalf of somebody else who they'd like to, you know, to put in a position of advantage, or is it really only for themselves? You see both things, and you see lots of variations of that. But it's put in a position to make a judgment about what you're going to do for yourself and what you're going to do for the world that we're going to be living in, because it's coming, then you need to be discerning. Think about why people are making the arguments that they're making. When I was a kid, I had a very good friend who told me that one of the things you always need to do when you can see somebody talking is you need to listen to what they're saying. At the same time, you need to remember and put those and remember what they're saying, and then watch what they do, and then compare the two. As a matter of fact, he would put it like that over and over. Remember what they say, watch what they do, compare the two. Because when you compare the two and you see what the difference is between them, what you're finding out is who really lives in that body, who really lives in that spirit, and what their real intentions are. It was an interesting time in my life. My first sort of ideological mentor was a guy named James Dean, and he also acted. And one of the things he sort of opened me up to looking at was the way the world is and the way that I was, and what I should think about that world. I think each of us probably meet somebody in our life that has that kind of signal effect on us, that we kind of reference back to over and over and over again because they're particularly significant or important. For me, that was Jimmy. He was a funny guy. He had a rubbery face. that he could become anybody. He could become my little brother. He could become my father. He could be the guy on the television set. Jim Carrey had nothing on Jimmy. And he was still the person, I think, that first got me thinking about thinking, which is something that I think each of us needs to do more of. Think. Confront your life. Look at all the different things around you that make that life rich. Think about the things that you bring to life that make other people's lives richer. Think about your relationship with the spirit. Think about your relationship with your grocer. Think about how people are going to see you, not because that matters so much, but because it should matter to you. Not because doing the right thing is something that defines us to. I always wondered what must have been in Rebecca Nurse's mind when they hanged her. She was in her 90s. She had lived a virtuous life, and actually the last thing that she said was, please, please, forgive these people and forgive what they're doing. Not much like the Hetman McCoys. And not really much of the story that you get from, you know, the popular things you've seen about the Salem witchcraft trials, probably. There is a tremendous richness in American history. There's a tremendous richness about looking at what people have chosen to do and about the statement they've made with their own lives. And I think that that's going to be equally true about the people we see in power today. I think when we understand who they are and what they've done, you know, history, it isn't going to just be history that judges them. It's going to be us. And as everybody has their day in the court of justice after they die, I have to tell you that I hope for these people that they have a day of justice in a court that's a lot closer, that's a lot more real, a court that is going to look at them and say, you did the wrong thing, and there's going to be a liability for that. And I think one of those liabilities should be that that it costs them. And this is Melinda Pillsbury Foster. I really enjoyed talking to you tonight about a lot of different things. God bless. Enjoy your life. Think about your life. And this is in TNT Radio coming at you tonight.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.